Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And I'm Eric Newton. Tonight we have Luke Stoddard Nathan, creator of Troy Letter, in the studio for a Collar City news update.
Then we have a new Nature Lab segment from correspondent Amy Halloran.
Afterwards, we'll hear part two of CollarWorks radio host Justin Baker's interview with Brian Sermo.
And then we have a new physics bucket with Dr. David Borton about quantum mechanics and parallel universes. But let's start the show off with some headlines.
The Whitney Young Health Center is planning to relocate its North Troy Health Center this summer to a space it says will better suit its patients. The center will move from its current spot at 6102nd Street to the Riverside Plaza at 849 2nd Ave, 2 miles away. The center will occupy just under 5,000 square feet in the plaza, whose anchors include Price Chopper, Hannaford, and Rite Aid.
Sunday is St. Patrick's Day, but the biggest celebrations will be Saturday, with both the North Albany Limericks and Albany Parades and the downtown Albany Irish Sweater 5K run. The North Albany Limerick Parade runs from noon to 1 p.m. The downtown Albany Irish Sweater 5K run is noon to 2 p.m. and will use the same roads as the St. Patrick's Day Parade. The parade is 2 to 4 p.m., but it will start and end on State Street between Broadway and Pearl Street.
Impressions of Saratoga is hosting a dog party to create a fun space for pups to mingle. Your furry friends will get a chance to do a little taste testing and enjoy some doggy brew. Dean's Delicious Dog Treats and Mutts and Barley is also on the menu. The dog party will be held Saturday at Impressions from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Attention boaters, the Fulton County Sheriff's Office is offering the New York State Boater Safety Course later this month. It's being held on March 25th and 27th at the Fulton County Emergency Operations Center on New York State Highway 29 in Johnstown. Each session starts at 4:30 p.m. and ends at 8:30 p.m. The course is free, and you must attend both sessions in order to receive certification. You must also pass a written exam. Students must be at least 10 years old to participate. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM Troy, 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/Media Sanctuary. And we're joined in the studio once again by Luke Stoddard Nathan, creator of Troy Letter and most recently A Tiny Human. Luke, welcome back.
Wow. Thanks. Yes, it's true. I am a father now, so it is doubly important, I guess, that my Patreon for this Troy Letter experiment succeed. I thought I'd give everybody a little brief update on that. I had started a Patreon, I guess, 2 weeks ago now, or about 2 weeks ago now, to support Troy Letter. And I said that if I got 50 supporters at $5 a month, I would continue for at least 3 more months. And if I got 200, I would continue for at least a year. I'm now well beyond the 50. I'm at a little, I think at least 100 or maybe slightly more than that. I just checked before I came on the air now. So I'm about halfway there to full funding, perhaps, or full part-time funding.
How can we help fund you? Where do we go?
Well, if you go to the Patreon page that I have set up, it's patreon.com/Troy Letter. You can pitch in there.
Is that Patreon?
That is. Okay. That's right. And you know, there's always links in my tiny letter. So if you're subscribed to that, which I hope you are, you can follow the links via the emails that you already get. In news, last week I spoke on the phone with Dara Silberman. Dara is the owner of Second Street Farm in South Troy. It's like a little tiny vacant lot, or it was a vacant lot until fairly recently when she bought it from the city. It was a foreclosed property, and she made it into a little vegetable farm that since last year and again this year will be selling shares of a vegetable CSA that runs from the or at least one season will run from the spring into the summer. It's going to cost $350, and that gets you 6 to 9 items. I guess it, you know, varies with the, you know, what the yield is or whatever, but it's kind of a cool thought. That's something I hadn't really thought about, although I was already aware of this farm that you could get produce that could conceivably feed a small family from a lot in South Troy, you know, next to just row houses in the middle of the city. And the reason I thought to speak to Dara this week, not only because, you know, I guess spring's around the corner, so I'm thinking about that stuff more, is that she, the city council, last week just approved her purchase of another lot. This one's on Oak Street, so a little bit east of where the Second Street Farm is, a bigger parcel than the one she owns, about 0.68 acres, but it's sloped and wooded, so I don't know that it would have. This is kind of a perfect use for it because I'm not sure what you could really build on this lot.
She got quite a good deal on it too, though.
$100, yeah, can't beat that, right? You can still buy lots for $100 in the city of Troy, vacant lots. That is probably not properties unless they're incredibly derelict.
Also plausible.
Which is plausible too. And she said there's already berry canes on the property that she thinks are going to be able to be put to use like almost immediately for her CSA this year. But she's also going to clear out the brush and the invasive plants and trees on the property and then plant fruit trees and edible plants. The way the Second Street Farm Stand works, you can join the CSA, but there's also a market stand that runs at the same time that people pick up their CSA, so you can then supplement from that if you so desire. And just as a little, just statistics wise, Darris said that already 22 people are signed up for this upcoming season, and then there's like 15 more people who might sign up, which is already a pretty big increase over last year, which I think she only had about 8 or 9 people who subscribed last year, or were subscribed at any given point in time last year. And just as a preview, in the next Troy Letter, so this Friday's Troy Letter, I'll have a little interview with the people behind Edible Uprising Farm, which is again east of Second Street, sort of up off of Thompson Street, kind of near where the South Troy Dodgers play. We're kind of near there's a Troy Housing Authority complex kind of near there also. And that's a new farm that's starting up, a little bit bigger, about an acre farm. It's still very much a work in progress, but they're aiming to open this year for this season, and they're selling CSAs as well. So look out for that if you're still kind of shopping around for an urban CSA to join. I guess there's at least 2 options in the city of Troy.
Is there any kind of limit on how many people they can accept and still meet the demand?
That's a good question. I don't know that I asked Dara how many people she could. I don't know that she has. Actually, you know what? I may have asked that, and she may have told me. I'm trying to recall from memory that she doesn't have a cap, because if her demand increases beyond what she can otherwise accommodate, she may supplement from other local farms. You know, just as a kind of service to bring them that. At Edible Uprising Farm, I did ask, they told me what their sort of upwards cap is, and I can't remember, so I have to look back at my notes. So look out on Friday. I'd imagine it's a few dozen people. I don't think they're shooting for any higher than like 30 to 50. I think it's in that range.
Gotcha.
There was a big city council meeting on Thursday, with also some like committee meetings that same night. Maybe the most talked about item on Thursday was the city council's vote along party lines. So it passed, because there's only 2 Republicans and 4 Democrats right now. It passed to award a $200,000 contract to River Street Planning for a full review and revision of the city's zoning code. The reason that this item, or one of the reasons that this item kind of attracted some controversy, was because the Republican mayoral candidate Tom Riehl got up and spoke during the public comment period and objected to the awarding of this contract because River Street Planning is owned by Margaret Irwin, who is Mayor Madden's ex-wife. Oh. They have not been together for nearly 2 decades. And when River Street Planning won a different contract, an earlier contract from the city, maybe a year ago, to handle the One Monument Square charrette and revisions, the mayor got an ethics opinion from the Ethics Commission, a volunteer board of the city, and they said that there was no conflict. In part because there's no financial ties between the couple anymore. And just as a thought experiment, you know, you could think back to what you were doing or what your life was like in 2003, which is, I think, when they separated. I mean, that is a significant amount of time. I mean, I'm not discounting the, you know, potential appearance of a conflict, you know, but it seemed, but I think that this, I don't know that this will be something that a lot of people necessarily are up in arms about. In this more recent case, River Street Planning was selected not by the mayor himself, but by the a staffer in the planning department oversaw a board, an advisory group of made up of like residents of the city who chose River Street Planning. And then furthermore, River Street Planning seems to have like a particular expertise in zoning related matters. They've handled zoning stuff for Schenectady, Albany, Rome, Oneida, and then a bunch of other smaller cities and towns. So
what kind of changes are they thinking about making?
As I understand it, and as the planning commissioner has said, the current zoning ordinance of the city, which basically says, you know, what can you build where and to what specifications, is a mess. It's sort of inconsistent. It's kind of geared more towards suburban style zoning, or, you know, now sort of the trendy, not trendy, but just like good urban planning practice is to build buildings pretty much flush to the curb rather than set back. All sorts of different things that make cities good maybe are not reflected as much in the code. Or if you want to build like a tattoo parlor, open a tattoo parlor, you have to go to the zoning board because it's not something that's written into the code. There's just a lot of things that need to be, I guess, modernized.
Do we know the last time the zoning code was updated?
I think it's been updated sporadically, but I don't know that there has been a wholesale, just like top to bottom. Like
comprehensive.
In probably decades. The comprehensive plan, which is like the blueprint for what the city should do, was only recently revised, and that hadn't been revised in decades. And usually when you do a new comprehensive plan, you then do a new zoning ordinance to kind of match. Like the comprehensive plan is sort of like in theory, and then the zoning ordinance is like what should be done in practice, you know, kind of making the visions of the city more sort of concrete and writing them into law. So that's the job of this. It's a pretty giant undertaking. It's going to involve a lot of public meetings and input. And they're aiming to complete the work within a year. So I guess the clock starts now. And they also, one other interesting tidbit that I put in the newsletter is that Irwin said that the team that she's assembled, it's not just like her doing all the work. They're going to have climate change adaptation specialists as part of the zoning team to think about, because a lot of Troy lies in a floodplain. So they're going to be thinking about, and a lot of the vacant land, or a lot of the land in like South Central Troy and South Troy that could otherwise be developed and should be thought about is in a floodplain. And so with, you know, water levels, you know, conceivably rising and other sort of changes, you know, linked to climate change, you know, how should the city plan for that or write that in? I don't know. How do you think about that? I guess that's something that's going to be discussed too.
You mentioned this episode of Troy Letter that the council president Carmela Mantello had her own reason for opposing River Street Planning getting this contract.
She did, and it's hard to call it anything other than whataboutism. You know, like her objection apparently is that. So half of the money that's funding this $200,000 contract is from the state, and then it's a grant. And then the other half is coming from this organization called the Troy Redevelopment Foundation, which is really just a group made up of the large nonprofits in the city, RPI, the hospitals, Sage, I think, that got together and decided they make a voluntary payment in lieu of taxes to the city, because they, you know, they're nonprofits, so they own a lot of property in the city, but they don't pay taxes on that property. So this is sort of like a concession, so to kind of keep the pitchforks away from them, you know. So I think they pay a little over $400,000 a year total to the city, and some of that money goes into the city's general fund. And then some of that money is like the city can do whatever they want with it. And then some of that money, they have some input into what the city does with it. And so the city is taking $100,000 of that money and using it for this zoning overhaul. And the council president said that she had already supported the award of this contract earlier. Now she's revoked her support for it, and ended up voting against it, because she thought that the $100,000 specifically should go toward fixing potholes or improving the city's surveillance cameras, which don't apparently work that well. You know, I don't think anyone is against fixing potholes or improving, you know, the city's surveillance cameras that are used, you know, largely for like determining culpability and like, you know, say car accidents or something like that. But it was just like, I think the Democrats on the city council were sort of like, you know, we can do both. You know, I don't think anyone would, the zoning, having a modern zoning ordinance, especially in this time where there seems to be this kind of boom of construction in the city. Like it would save a lot of staff time, you know, to have something that's easier to follow. Mm-hmm. That's in sort of plain language that, you know, if Joe Schmo wants to fix his property or renovate his garage or whatever, it's easier for him to do that. Or to be able to know how to do that. So that growth in the city is the way we want it, or that the public agrees, you know, so that, development follows in patterns that we want to see, and development goes where people want to see it, and where buildings should be built tall, they can be built tall, and where they shouldn't, they won't. You know, these are the sorts of things that zoning, you know, regulates. So to have it seems vitally important that the zoning ordinance is modern. So I think it was David Besember who said that it seemed like a false dichotomy to say that you could, you know, that we shouldn't update our zoning ordinance until we fill all the potholes.
Right, you know? Right. Yeah. Speaking of filling holes, there is an open seat in the city council itself that needs to be filled, formerly Mark McGrath's. And supposedly there's an update on that?
Well, an update of sorts. On Thursday, Anasha Cummings, the downtown council member, said that the Democratic majority has interviewed four. There's been 10 people who have applied to fill the seat. These are residents of North Central, the area, the general area that Mark McGrath served in District 2. The majority's interviewed four. They're going to interview two more. Maybe they already have. They were expecting to get back to applicants this week. So yeah, so they're any day now. I guess we could see that spot be filled. And the city council minority at this meeting last week was sort of putting pressure on the Democrats to get it done, one, or and also to include them, which is sort of odd because Mark McGrath resigned after the Times Union published a racist voicemail that he had, I guess, inadvertently left someone years ago. I don't recall either of his Republican colleagues actually calling for him to resign. I think the most that they may have said was, you know, it's up to him, and that, you know, I think they condemned the comments, but they didn't actually call for him to resign. Now they want, you know, input as far as who replaces him. But I think it was only the mayor and members of the city council who actually called for him to resign. So you might say, they were the one, I don't know, we'll see. We'll see who they pick. They may pick someone who's, who everybody likes. But
we'll see.
I don't know.
And so then we're running a little low on time. But if there's one thing from that city council meeting or elsewhere in Troy that you want to get out there, now would be the time.
Oh, well, the city published an RFP or an RF or an RFP for renovations related to the South Troy Pool. This is a big sort of push that the mayor is making to get the South Troy Pool renovated by this summer. It's a re-election year for the mayor and for the city council, so I'd imagine that they are keen to have that accomplished. So I guess we'll see, how many bids come back or if any bids come back. And if it can be done at the budget that is, it is expected to be able.
Yeah,
to
and in the
at.
Time frame.
And within the time frame, yeah.
It's coming up quick it this
could,
summer.
Could be a tough job.
Definitely, but when people want to follow what's going on in Troy, where do they go?
You can go to tinyletter.com/Troy_letter, or you can email me at luke.s.nathan@gmail.com, and just say sign me up.
Excellent. Thank you very much for joining us, Luke. We look forward to seeing you next week. And if you want to support him, you can go to patreon.com/Troy Letter.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Luke.
Thank you.
Next up, we have Nature Lab correspondent Amy Halloran speaking with Ellie Irons about her latest bio art project. And it's not what you'd expect.
Hi, I'm Amy Halloran, and I'm here today with Ellie Irons to talk about the nature of her work, which includes these days something very different.
Yes.
Hi, Ellie. Would you introduce yourselves?
Yeah. So good to be here with you, Amy. So I am a PhD student at RPI in the Electronic Arts Department, but I also do a lot of work here at the Sanctuary with Nature Lab. We've been doing kind of youth education programs and exploring the ways that the ecosystem around here is actually really lively with a lot of different kinds of spontaneous plants, as I like to call them. Some people think of them as weeds, but we've been getting to know them through a variety of processes of different experiments we're doing at Nature Lab. So,
can you name one of the experiments just to give a little texture for
people? Sure, yeah. So there's a bunch of ongoing things. One thing people like a lot is my invasive and feral pigments project, which is where we wander around the neighborhood looking for spots of color on plants, and we collect them. So that could be like a brightly colored leaf or a flower petal or even like the pollen in the middle of a flower. And I have this watercolor process I've kind of adapted, making watercolors using the plant parts. So we can kind of create this rainbow of colors based on the landscape, everything from a dandelion in a sidewalk crack to like a wild cherry or something like that, and make paintings.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's great. Yeah. So that sounds like a really interesting way to engage with the world around us. And but today I want to talk to you about the engagement you're having with the world inside and now around you.
Yes.
As a mother.
That's
your
right.
Latest nature experiment.
That's right. Yeah. I have a baby girl who's 5 weeks old right about now. And that's been, yeah, like you said, probably the most intense experiment that I've encountered in my life so far. It's been mind blowing and really fun and also really hard.
It's pretty amazing that we can be intellectual and still have all these animal processes and become, for me, that was the first time I think I slowed down enough to look at a leaf.
Yeah.
And what was it like for you? Did you tell me about the kind of inner explosions that happened as you went through pregnancy?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, it was funny because I was trying to birth a qualifying exam for my PhD program at the same time as I was around 6 to 7 months pregnant with her. And it was fascinating to be thinking about the kind of intense intellectual process that my brain was going through at the same time I was feeling her kicking and fluttering around inside me. And there's this joke about like how many words kids get exposed to. And I was thinking about the ridiculous lexicon of like PhD words that I was like speaking while she was in the belly. And it was actually really nice to have the grounding presence of her there reminding me. physicality is going to be an ongoing important thing in my life, because my art practice is very physically engaged and about field work and landscapes, and it can be so kind of abstract and esoteric to be writing a paper. So
right.
Yeah.
So you had in your body an embodiment.
Yes.
That was really making you pay attention.
Totally. And like, she was very, I mean, I think a lot of babies are active, but my baby is so active. She was just always brushing and pushing. And so, yeah, it was exhausting, but also I kind of really enjoyed doing that writing process with her.
Uh-huh. You know, so, that's great.
Yeah.
Was it surprising to you, or did you have an anticipation of what those physical feelings might be, because your art is nature and observation?
I think it kind of took me by surprise, in a delightful way. I mean, it was a little startling, the first very strong punches she gave. But I actually told my collaborators, I work on a project called the Environmental Performance Agency, which has a few choreographers and kind of somatically body-oriented people in it. And I come from a visual arts background, but I've been working with them for a couple years, and they've really helped me tune into my body and be much more comfortable with tuning into the physical side of my body, which was harder for me prior. And I'm actually so grateful for that practice in retrospect. It really helped me navigate being pregnant and the birth process, to like have this kind of relationship. They taught me how to kind of choreograph my field work in a way to be like more embodied, to be more physically present with the plants that I work with. So
what did that look like? Describe to me.
Well, one of my collaborators actually dances with plants. Like, she uses, she's a, I think they call it the Laban method. And she actually like is able to kind of take choreography and notate it. But she can also like translate the movement of a plant through really hard work. She'll translate the movement of a plant into a movement she does in her own body. So she'll take in the way a particular plant, say Virginia pepperweed. So my daughter's named Virginia, and Virginia pepperweed is a plant that we all love. So I named her Virginia for many reasons, but we all love the pepperweed. So Virginia pepperweed is a very upright plant with these little discs that stick off it that catch the wind in just a certain way. So this collaborator of mine, Andrea Henke, will sit with pepperweed for a long time and kind of slowly get a rhythm with it and start moving, and then try to figure out how she can take those movements that pepperweed kind of caused her to do in the field back into a performance space or something.
That's wild.
So, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, no, and it's very wild.
No pun intended. All puns intended.
Yeah.
Are you inspired at all by that in your art and in your life by the disconnect we as humans have from nature?
I mean, I think that the past, well, probably my whole life, but the past 10 years have been more cognizant of needing to overcome that. And like that this is a false binary that's, you know, been driven into us. I mean, moving to New York City from the rural West Coast, I think, really showed me, oh, wait, I'm going to have to work hard to feel like I'm part of an ecosystem that's not completely predicated by like human design. So I think that's part of what's driven me to look at the spontaneous urban plants, the weeds, is because they really prove that there's this kind of coevolution between humans and nature. The plants are here because we're here, but we can't control them. We try to spray herbicide on them. They come back stronger. There's this crazy taming cycle, and we're heavily involved in it, which just tells me that it's a continuum. It's not even a continuum. It's a complete knotted entanglement between humans and all the other living things and the land. And so any way that I can get at that in my personal life or through my practice is, drives me.
That's great. Yeah. Do you have any, 5 weeks is early in.
Yeah.
But do you have any, I don't want to say the word lessons, but witnessing or reports you want to share about the experience of giving birth and being a new mother and entering into this next cycle phase of your life?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely still processing it, like you said. It's early on, but I think I'm pretty blown away by just, you know, people tell you things about what it will be like, and you're like, oh, maybe, but like, it's really intensely crazy. The amount of, or just like, I think I said mind blowing, like the amount of kind of how hard your body can work for one thing to produce this baby. That, like you said, kind of connects you to your animal side of yourself that you maybe don't understand. We figured out, I guess what it is, one insight is we figured out how to take away so many of those processes. We don't have to butcher our own meat anymore. We don't have to, some choose to, but we don't have to harvest our own plants. But still, a lot of women go through this process that is so animal, and there's nothing you can do to make it pretty, right? I mean, it's beautiful in its own way, but it's not going to be tied up and neat. And neither is the process of having the kid. I poop and spit all over me all the time, and that's just the way it's going to be. She's a little pupa, in addition to very much having her own personality and already being a full being.
But a super connected full being to you, and
yes,
latching you outwards back into. I loved that animal nature of getting to know the world
through the eyes of another being that you're so tightly in a loop with, right?
It's a pretty amazing journey.
Definitely.
Yeah. Cool.
I look forward to getting to the state that you're at with it.
It'll happen in a flash.
I know.
You're in a quick infinity right now.
Yeah. Totally. Oh, that's a really nice way to put it. Quick infinity.
That's what it is. Because all the moments are really long.
Totally. So true.
Right. Well, Ellie Irons, thank you so much for sharing with me a little bit about your work. Enjoy all of it.
Yeah. And same, Amy.
Sure.
Nice talking with you.
You too.
Again, that was Amy Halloran interviewing Ellie Irons in the Sanctuary Studio.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And I'm Eric Newton. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, 105.3 FM and 98.9 FM Schenectady. Up next, CollarWorks Radio correspondent Justin Baker continues his talk with artist Brian Sermo.
Hi, this is CollarWorks Radio. This is Justin Baker, and we're here expanding the local arts vernacular by talking to local artists. This week, my guest is Brian Sermo. Hey, Brian, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for being here, and we're going to talk about all things that are awesome in Brian in a second, but first I just want to say that he's got a show coming up at the Courthouse Gallery in Lake George, New York, and that's at 1 Amherst Street, Lake George, New York, and it's running March 9th to April 12th. The opening reception is March 9th, 4 to 6 p.m., and that's a Saturday. So last segment, we were kind of talking about what people could expect to see in the show. I think we talked about, was it 17 paintings, or was it more than that?
It's around there. I think it's 17 or 18 paintings, give or take.
So I thought here we could just talk a little bit, give our listeners like a little idea of how you go about making your paintings, maybe where you studied, who you studied with, what your influences are. I know we do share a common bond in SUNY Albany MFA program, but you were, I finished in 07, I think. And then when did you finish there?
I graduated in 02.
02. Okay.
Yeah.
So a while before me. Okay.
Yeah. Amazing. Was that long ago? Wow.
It's scary when you think about it. You also went to St. Rose, got your BFA there. I do want to mention you are a professor out at Onondaga Community College. So that's pretty awesome too.
Yeah.
Painting and drawing.
Yep.
Right. Yeah. So painting for you, I do want to say, because looking at your website and just kind of getting to know you a little bit more this summer at the residency program that CollarWorks does, you are prolific. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I like the work.
Okay.
And that CollarWorks residency, by the way, Elizabeth Murray residency, that was an amazing time. I had just
thank you for that. Yeah.
I just had an amazing time there. The people, the environment, it was killer. So yeah, that was great.
So I guess my question about the prolificity—I don't know if that's the right word or not, or if that's even a word. But is it something? Do you approach painting every day?
I'm always working.
You're always working.
I'm always working. I love to work. I've structured my life around the idea of working. And so, you know, people always say that, you know, the most important things in your life are your family, your friends, and then maybe your work. And it might sound bad, but I put my work right up there.
Right up there.
In contention. Like, I don't put it third. I just love to work. It gives me just absolute joy. So I do work a lot. I travel between the cities. I live in Albany, but I also live in Syracuse, and I'm out there during the week teaching, and I come back to Albany on the weekends. So I have a studio set up here in Albany, New York, and then I have a space set up in Syracuse. So I'm always drawing and painting in both places every week, on the weekends and during the week. So I've always just kind of structured my life around making that work. It's very, really important to me. So I just love to do it. I just love to do it. So
when you're working in, like, because you had mentioned before you work in like a series, what's the usually like the genesis for that idea?
So it also, my work doesn't get made unless I'm reading, listening to music, or you know, looking at art, doing some kind of, so I have a whole wall in my studio that's just, so for instance, the Gray Matter series of paintings, my newest series, that all started with a quote from Lewis's Babbitt, where I believe it was, "Gray fear loomed by him always now." And I love that line, and just, so I wrote it down, put it on the wall. And so I just kind of allow these lyrics or these little passages from books to kind of, from literature, to kind of congregate on the wall. And so ideas start to pop up. And so I start to draw. And so it's just the way, I don't think it's very different than the way a lot of artists work. You know, we just kind of culminate ideas and kind of build our work from there. But yeah, it's the way I work. And so I did a whole series called Black a couple years ago. And that whole series started from a Bob Dylan lyric. I'm a huge Dylan fan. A Bob Dylan lyric where he says, "Black is the color, none is the number." I was like, oh man, I probably heard that lyric 1,000 times, but all of a sudden I heard it that one time, and it just sparked something new.
Struck you.
Yeah. And so that's just kind of how things. So if I'm not listening to music, if I'm not reading, it's really difficult to make stuff. Or I repeat myself a lot if I'm not kind of researching.
Interesting.
And kind of engaging.
Okay.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff do you look at that, like, art wise, is getting you going these days? Is there anything?
Nicole Eisman is, I think she's the best American painter right now. Her stuff's just amazing. It's just endlessly inventive, endlessly new. It's funny. It's dark. It's weird. It's
is she
political.
A figurative painter?
She's a figurative painter and sculptor. And then Dana Schutz has always been a fan, I've been a big fan of her work. So those are some of the contemporary painters that her new show in New York, which I think closes tomorrow, is just an amazing show. And then obviously people like Peter Saul and Philip Guston.
Okay.
I discovered those guys my junior year of college, and I realized for a long time I tried to suppress the whole cartoon, the whole kind of low culture image in my work, and I was going to be a painter. I was going to be a
like
real
a
painter, make,
abstract
you know,
painter
big or abstract paintings,
okay.
And
big macho paintings.
And then I went to New York City on a school trip, and I walked around the corner in this gallery, McKee Gallery, and there was a Guston painting, and I was like, I can do that.
Like his later stuff? That's
yeah,
like
those
really
later
funky.
Chunky yeah. cartoon. And then I saw a Peter Saul, one of his Vietnam paintings.
Okay.
And I was like, whoa, this stuff is intense. So, I mean, I wouldn't the work I make now just wouldn't exist if I didn't experience those two painters.
Yeah, I could see that for sure. Because you're figurative, and it's got a weirdness to it that's intriguing, sometimes kind of funny. Like that newest one I saw of yours, Loom, I found that one that was striking. That was like really pretty wild. It had some humor to it, but it was also like very grotesque and interesting. And
I'm doing a series of drawings, big drawings now called Monster Drawings.
Right.
And they're all loosely based off of the Trump administration.
Right.
I don't think they'll ever be shown because they're really large and there's no way anyone's ever going to show them. But I started thinking of the idea of the boogeyman.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's where the image of Loom came. Mm-hmm. It's a really weird painting. That should be in the show in Lake George.
Yeah,
yeah,
I'd love to see that.
So
yeah.
It should be good.
Yeah. There's a really, I don't know, seeing it online, there's a kind of a beauty to it that's really engaging. So when you're in the studio, you work in oils, right? Is that?
Yeah, I'm purely oil. I do use gouache when I do some drawings. So some of my drawings are charcoal, pencil, and gouache. But mostly I don't paint in anything other than oil on canvas. That's my main medium. I used to use acrylics here and there when I first started painting, but I'm mostly oil now, yeah.
Right. I just remember from the residency, there's a glow to them that's really... I remember they had this light to them. Or actually even what I saw at Collarwork show, the Made in Granville show, where you had on display... How many canvases was that? It was like the...
18. There's 18 canvases. In it, yeah.
Yeah, it was really... they had a light to them that was really kind of beautiful. So... Well, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you.
And if you had to give us one Bob Dylan record to listen to, what would it be?
Oh, it's so hard. I got to give you two. All right.
I'll put you on the spot.
I got to give you two. It would be Blood on the Tracks and Time Out of Mind.
Okay. Awesome. I wish those could take us out, but next time we'll have you in. So again, Brian Sermo. Painting. What is it? Is it paintings by Brian Sermo?
It's Brian Sermo paintings.
Yeah. Go look at him. You won't be disappointed. It's Courthouse Gallery in Lake George, New York, 1 Amherst Street. And as always, go check out Collarworks, 621 River Street, Troy, New York. We have the Ever Upward show, which is really fun. I don't know if you've been to see that yet.
Great show. I stopped by the other day.
Recent MFA graduates from all around New York. That comes down in March 16th, on March 16th, Opalka Gallery, go check that out, Place of Now, and then the Mandeville Gallery in Schenectady, New York, that's at Union College, A Decolonial Atlas, Strategies in Contemporary Art of the Americas. All right, thank you very much. Thanks, Brian. Thanks for being here.
Thank you to Justin Baker and Brian Sermo for sharing that piece with us.
Up next, physicist and solar boat builder David Borton is back with WOOC correspondents Megan Marone and Sarone Cunningham.
Okay, so how do we define physics?
It's rules of how the world works. Gravity, light, density, mass, it's all relates to physics.
Aren't there a lot of exceptions to those rules? Not so much.
No.
Now, if you
like
travel
when a ghost walks through the wall,
if you travel at the speed of light,
okay,
then the physics changes a little bit. It doesn't negate the physics of us sitting around this table. It just expands the physics to include things going closer to the speed of light. And quantum mechanics, we haven't talked about that, but quantum mechanics says there's a finite probability that this mug of tea will fall right through this glass table. Oh. Now, it's not going to happen, okay? I'm not worried about that, right? Because it's not going to happen, because the probability is so very small. But there is a probability. The wave function is such that it could fall right through there, but it doesn't.
Have you ever had something inexplicable happen to you?
Oh, lots of inexplicable things happen. The fact that you asked
that
question.
Then are they tears in the quantum... How to frame that question?
Well, okay. There's a ongoing question right now about dark matter. Does it exist? If it is, what is it? And it's possible that it's just normal matter that we can't see that's out there in the universe in the form of thin gas that we just don't know is there. So there's a question we don't know the answer to.
Why are people so interested in dark matter?
Well, can dark matter be used for energy?
E equals mc squared. So if there's matter, there's energy. They're intimately related by the speed of light squared, which is a very big number. So these are ongoing questions as to how the larger universe works outside of the little bitty galaxy that we happen to be involved with.
Doesn't that fascinate you? Like, don't you think it's really cool that the laws of physics might change outside of the galaxy?
No, I didn't say change.
Oh.
I said we haven't understood that part of the physics yet.
Well, I'm going to go there. Do you think that there's anything to quantum physics theories about there being parallel universes right next to you and I all the time?
Well, yeah, I've heard that because there's this show on Netflix called Stranger Things. And they always talk about, they call it the other side or whatever. And that
the upside down.
The upside down, right. And that is based on another reality and whatnot. And there have been theories out there that there could be a parallel universe out there, but that goes into other sciences that I really don't know about.
That's really exciting. Is there anything to that idea of universes, parallel universes right next to ours?
Okay, suppose I flip a coin.
Okay. I have a rune right here.
Okay.
Flip the rune. Well, one side is blank and the other, yeah.
Okay. So one side comes up, you get me dinner. The other side comes up, you get me dinner. Parallel universe. I either get dinner from you or I get dinner from you, and they're not going to be the same dinner. Parallel universe. I'm not worried about it because this...
You get dinner anyway, and that's right.
And it's possible that this thing would land on its edge. Okay?
What does that mean? So one side is dinner by Megan, the other side's dinner by Sarone.
And the other side is me. If it lands on its edge, I'll get dinner for both of you.
Oh, it's on its edge. It's on its edge. But, yeah, do you think that we just don't think about that because we could go nuts?
Yeah, I feel like you can go off and maybe go crazy by thinking of all the parallel universes and all the other possibilities that could happen, but how realistic is that? Is that a real reality that I should be worried about? Because I know there's something about quantum physics or when not, like, things could phase through other things, but I'm not worried about that because this cup is not going to phase through this table. And it's not going to fall on the floor and shatter millions of pieces.
But there is a potentiality that it could.
There is, but how important is it?
That's a very good statement. It's not important. Don't worry about it.
Okay, I think it's very important.
Why?
And what if it did fall through the table?
Okay. What's the odds that I'm going to get struck by lightning right now and you two guys are not going to get struck by lightning?
Let's say a little blessing that that doesn't happen.
No, yeah. Let's just say that the odds are so small, none of us worries about it.
Yeah, it's not a direct threat. So no scientist is going to dedicate their time on how to figure out something because I feel like physics and other sciences that are out there are to protect us from the dangers of the world, like gravity. Everyone knows the threats and dangers of gravity. You go up, you can fall down, have the potential of falling down and hurting yourself. You know what that impact could potentially do to you. But if you're on the ground, should you worry about being up there? You're on the ground, so you can look up as long as you want. It's not a threat. So I feel like you thinking of the quantum realms and the parallel universes is like you looking up. There's no real...
When you're on the ground.
Yeah, when you're on the ground, and so there isn't a real danger of other universes affecting your day-to-day well-being.
Okay, so I feel like I'm with two people who are recommending that we stay grounded and that we also accept that the scientific community is trying to protect us by going forward with these assumptions and these rules that we can move forward even with these very minute quantum chances of things not working the way we're used to, that we can proceed and move forward with the assumption that these rules are always in place. And I know you don't even want me to say that it's an assumption that the rules are in place, that the rules are in place.
Rules are something that we have figured out through the scientific process.
And then it's also based on our love and acceptance of logic and reason that we've used the scientific process of trial and error to get to the point where we move forward with these rules of physics and rules of science.
Right. Whereas rules of law are not necessarily rational.
Isn't it kind of cool to think that in this potential of that cup falling through the table, that there's some other table right next to us with some other Sarone and some other Dr. Borton and some other Megan? That's where it gets exciting to think about that totally minute infinitesimal possibility. Agree or disagree?
That's fiction.
That's the upside down.
Right.
That's Stranger Things.
But with global warming and summers getting longer and winters getting shorter and things like that happening, more tornadoes are occurring and things like that. Is the slow change in the geographical environment weather-wise, is that kind of changing the rule or slowly changing the rules of physics?
It's not changing the rules of physics. It's changing the outcome.
So with the, what's the thing around the planet that protects the planet?
Ionosphere?
Yeah, the breakdown, like you were talking earlier about meteors that go through the sky, like with that getting weaker, is that something in the physics world that maybe other scientists are worried about? And how could we as a community help strengthen our fears that are protecting the planet?
Well, one of the things we did talk about was ozone and the ozone layer and how chlorofluorocarbons attack the ozone layer and weaken it, which is to the detriment of human life and other life on planet Earth. So that's something that the Montreal Protocol actually did something about, and it's means that the ozone layer is actually getting thicker the way it normally would be if there wasn't the hydrochlorocarbon.
What about the other spheres, though, beyond the ozone layer to protect them from the, not the changing rules, but the changing outcomes of global warming and climate change?
Well, there's a ionosphere, and that really is a lot of protection from the solar wind, which is a plasma coming from the sun. And then outside of that, there's a magnetosphere, and that's more protection. We are beneficiaries of those things, and if those things went away, we would be hurting. But so far, people haven't screwed those up very much.
I really appreciate that question, because I feel like you just articulated something that I not just wanted to ask, but it's not that global warming or climate change changes the rules of physics, but it just feels like the planet is changing in such strange ways because of climate change, like you were saying about the snow in Arizona. Yeah, so it almost feels like we're entering this world where reality is shifting. I mean, it's not, too. Like, trees are growing normally in Troy. Or other moments, it feels like nature is becoming something that we didn't recognize before. Animals living in different places, or snow on a flower, or things like that. It might almost feel like the rules of physics could change, even though they never will.
Well, things try to adapt to whatever their environment is. And so, you know, people are called snowbirds who leave Troy and go to Florida for the winter. Well, at some point, the people in Florida are not going to want to be there in the summertime, and they may move to Troy. People that normally live in Florida, they're going to say, this is too hot. It's no longer viable for humans to live in Florida, so they're going to be coming north. And Troy actually is a really nice spot in terms of climate and rain and food and water supply, so this is a pretty good place from that perspective.
Thank you for allowing me to ask you questions and educating me more on what the world of physics involves and how we benefit from it, so thank you.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with both of you.
Thanks again to David Borton, Megan Marone, and Saron Cunningham.
Kevin Mullen and his wife, Jenny Kemp, opened Rare Form Brewing Company in downtown Troy in 2014. And at Rare Form, they share their love of beer and art. And Kevin is here with us to tell us more. Thank you for being here, Kevin.
Thank you for having me.
So you and Jenny wanted to open a brewery years before Rare Form came to be. Can you share the origin story?
Yeah, absolutely. So I got into beer a long time ago, early 1990s, and I was living in Colorado at the time, met Jenny, my wife, who was also big into beer. We moved to Seattle, and long story short, started brewing quite a bit and wanted to open a brewery out there. Thought that we would put it off a little bit, and she would go to get her master's in fine arts painting. So we started looking for programs, and that was what brought us out here. A year and a half, 2 years into the program, kind of fell in love with Troy and decided to start looking at least in this area first and some other towns around as well. We looked at Hudson and looked at Beacon, but then kind of settled on Troy, and we're now open and about a half a block away from where we were living at that time too.
And so how do you decide what beers you want to brew? It's certainly an art form in itself, and I'm sure a lot goes into it. How do you pick one?
You know, that's something that I take really kind of precious. I think about ones that I really like to drink first and foremost. Two is something that's always going to kind of challenge us and make us learn something more as we're brewing it. And there's a lot of styles out there that are not overly done. So I want to kind of pick one of those and work with those a little bit as well. And that's the fun part about it, you know, is being creative and being able to be innovative, but at the same time, pull a little history and these other recipes that are out there in the past from years ago or not being brewed too often, and then make our own little tweak to it and do how we make it taste how we want it to taste on.
And so how does the city of Troy itself influence your choices?
The city has been really helpful with it. One is we just like the art culture that's here. That's a big piece of us for us. You know, we first moved into Albany, and not knock on Albany, but all of our friends were living in Troy at the time we were meeting, and the art community here in 2009 was starting to really kind of take off. And so we came over here and we started being a part of another gallery called Collar Works. And then we were originally trying to find a space that we could have Collar Works and the brewery together or somewhat together. That didn't quite work out, but now we both have two different spaces, so we're happy.
And tell us about this Carass Porter and the coconut Carass.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Carass Porter, really nice, robust porter, has a lot of body to it. It's 6% alcohol. You don't taste any of that alcohol, which is kind of mid-range, which is really nice. You get this roasty characteristic, almost iced coffee on there, but with a really smooth finish and nice mouthfeel to it.
I noticed like a few of the beers that you have. You have like the nut brown ale and a couple kinds of porter there. They seem to be on the rise versus it was really like all IPAs was super popular for a while. You feel like they're a bit played out maybe?
You know, you want to think that, but it's not the case. It's crazy. You can take all the other beer styles in the entire world, put them all together, and IPA is still going to sell more than all of them combined. It's amazing, you know, and there's breweries that are opening up in other places. You can go down to Florida and hit a brewery that they have 12 beers and every single one of them is a New England style IPA and they're not making anything else. So I don't think the style is going anywhere relatively soon, but there are, you know, a lot of the brewers kind of tend to lead how that beer transitions out. And a lot of brewers are making pilsners and tasting pilsners and drinking alt beers and drinking Schwartz beers, which I think we might see a little bit more rise in lagers as we did with sours as well. But that kind of started with brewers drinking them and then people starting to catch that on. But it will be hard for the IPAs to kind of fade off. I mean, I like them too, but each beer has its own place.
Absolutely. What new style are you starting to get into now that you might want to incorporate onto your lineup later?
I really like our Mexican lager. It's a Mexican lager. It has 20% New York corn in there. So we use nice corn, which adds this kind of soft tortilla shell characteristic in there on the bottom of the beer, which is really nice and just really refreshing.
And your brewery supports local artists and locally produced snacks. Where does that collaboration come from?
You know, a lot of it is people's art that we like. My wife's being an artist, and we're both board members on Colorworks as well. And so we have a lot of people around here that make some really good art. And then we tap them in for certain things along those lines. And then we use, you know, a lot of Jenny's work for almost everything as well. And the majority part of that. Snacks is, you know, farmer's market. We go to the farmer's market, see things that we like and enjoy and see how we can put it on a plate together with other things and combine those flavors.
And you have some upcoming events at Rare Form this week, right?
We do. Yeah. Every Wednesday we have our trivia night. And this weekend is the Kilt Crawl, Troy Kilt Crawl, which is a combination between, I think it's 15 different bars in town are all going to have a beer from one of the three breweries that are here in the area, us, Browns, and Schmaltz. And we've all teamed up together to have different events and different stuff at all of those places. So it'll be a really fun trip.
Is the kilt mandatory?
No.
Where can people find you on social media?
We have a Facebook page, we have an Instagram and a Twitter. Facebook is Rare Form Brewing, pretty much straightforward.
Excellent. And otherwise, can you tell us where the tap room is?
Yeah, we're at 90 Congress Street, right between 3rd and 4th. And if you're around there, we're Kitty Corner from Mannery's and Kitty Corner from Troy Kitchen.
All right. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
We look forward to drinking more of your products.
Well, thank you.
Again, that was Kevin Mullen, co-founder of Rare Form Brewing, telling us about the brewery's vision. You can stop by Rare Form any day of the week, 90 Congress Street in downtown Troy. Visit rareformbrewing.com to see their hours.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And I'm Eric Newton. Our engineer tonight is Amy Loria. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page.
And that's all we've got, folks. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.